Morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. Glad everyone could make it. Before we get started, I'd like to note three things. First, Judge Sparks will be participating on the record. Number two, we are delighted again to have Senior Judge Crawford sitting with us as our fifth judge. And number three, our first case, United States v. Miller. There are three issues which have been certified by the Judge Advocate General of the Navy, and therefore the government will argue first. So, Lieutenant Crochetier, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Horst, are you prepared to argue on behalf of Pelley?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Crawford, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Catherine Crochetier, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Chris Blosser, I represent the United States. Chief Judge Olson, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please?
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. By requiring completed post-trial proceedings before convening authority action and staff judge advocate review, the lower court created an ultra vires judicial rule that disregarded the new rules prescribed by the President. Accordingly, this court should vacate for two reasons. First, nothing in the new rules required the convening authority or staff judge advocate to consider or even wait for the post-trial ruling. Second, the substantial omission framework no longer applies to convening authority action because post-trial processing is now concurrent with and not subsequent to certification of the record. First, the lower court erred finding the convening authority's action premature and the staff judge advocate's review uninformed, where the rules did not require them to wait for the post-trial ruling. This improperly heightened the standard for post-trial processing. Under the old rules, the record had to be completed and authenticated before being served to the accused and victim, who then had up to 30 days from receipt to submit clemency matters. Then the staff judge advocate would prepare a written recommendation using the record, and then the recommendation would be served on to the accused and the victim, who then had the opportunity to submit a written response to the recommendation. Then the convening authority's action would be the last step before the case moved on to the appellate process. Under the new rules, the President elected to change, not maintain, this old system. Now, the first step after announcement of the sentence is the accused and victim's submission of 1106 and 1106A matters, followed by the convening authority consultation with the staff judge advocate, convening authority action, entry of judgment, and then finally certification of the record. Contrary to this new system, the lower court held that all substantive rulings of the military judge must exist before a convening authority determines what to consider before taking action. However, nothing in RCM 1109 supports this holding. Instead, RCM 1109 only requires that the convening authority consider timely 1106 and 1106A matters, consult with the staff judge advocate, and ensure the action occurs before entry of judgment.
Now, Appelli seems to move beyond the four corners of the rule and says that what happened here is that it's apparent that the convening authority was very interested in the facts of this case, delved into the record. And essentially they're saying that the staff judge advocate was hiding the ball from the convening authority and that that's the issue here. How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, there is nothing in the record that indicates that the convening authority was interested in other matters. And he clearly and unambiguously stated in the convening authority's action, JA 180, in paragraph 9, matters considered, in taking this action, I have considered the pretrial agreement of 3 April 2019, statement of trial results of 8 May 2019, and correction thereto of 11 July 2019, and the two defense counsel letters of 17 May 2019. Now, the convening authority could have elected to review the full record, but he didn't. And the convening authority's action does not indicate that he was interested in other matters. Now,
counsel, on that point, I think counsel for the appellee says there's an ambiguity in that whole statement because there was no correction. What does the government make of that?
Your Honor, there was no ambiguity in the convening authority's action, and by reading the plain language of the action, we can take it as it is, that he considered the pretrial agreement, the statement of trial results, and the two defense counsel letters, and nothing more. Nothing in there indicates that he elected to review the full record but considered only specific parts, or that he considered the record of proceedings or the transcript, or decided that only certain documents of the entire record that he had in front of him he was interested in. And the fact that the clemency matters had been submitted, that he considered the clemency matters, and that the clemency matters did not discuss anything about the post-trial confinement or about a pending motion, anything like that, gives us cause to believe that there was nothing that would have caught his attention. And that is similar to I apologize.
Take your time.
That is similar to what this court found in Scalo, where the appellant in that case, the accused, had believed there was staff judge advocate error for not alerting the convening authority to the accused pretrial restraint, where the court found, no, this was not prejudice, it was not error, because there was nothing in the clemency matters that asked the convening authority to consider that pretrial restraint. So in this case, very similar, there is nothing to indicate that the belated post-trial motion and the facts within that motion would have caught the attention of the convening authority if the accused at the time didn't even raise the issue in his clemency matters. So because of that, we can read the convening authority's action to be unambiguous and to know that his intent was not to review anything outside of the documents that he said he considered.
So from the government's perspective, what was the CCA doing here? Was the CCA simply misreading the applicable provisions? Was the CCA trying to impose the old rules? Was the CCA trying to create an equitable remedy here rather than relying more properly on the law? What is the government's position here about what the CCA was up to?
Your Honor, the CCA in this case was trying to impose the old rules and the old system onto this new system. I think perhaps they were trying to fill in a gap that they thought existed in the new rules. However, that's not the case. And the rules were written in a way that clearly was changed and reformed by the President. And so now we have this new change under the Military Justice Act where the record of trial is not required to be completed until at the very end of the game. And the convening authority's action happens much earlier than that. So there's nothing in the rules that require at this stage for the record to be complete. I think an important point to note in this case, the appellee does look at 1106 Charlie and argue that because the accused has the right to access the record in clemency matters, that this means potentially that the record of proceedings is not complete until all the post-trial matters are completed. But that's incorrect. And we know that from the remainder of 1106, where there's a time limitation that specifically states the accused has 10 days after announcement of the sentence to submit clemency matters, up to an additional 20 days for good cause. And the rule in this case does not toll for post-trial matters, nor does anywhere in RCM 1104, which discusses post-trial matters, state anything about tolling for clemency for the appellee to receive, for the accused to receive additional records.
Counsel, can I ask just about that 10-day period? It wasn't clear from the record if the defense had received the statement of trial results on the same day they were issued or there was a gap. I mean, The rule, I think, says receipt, but we only have the document and its date. Is it the assumption that it was received on the date that it was issued?
That is the assumption, Your Honor. That is the assumption, but regardless of when the statement of trial results was received, the time for the clemency starts at the announcement of the sentence. So that would have no effect on the period for clemency anyway.
The rule says that the convening authority only has to consider the portions of the record that the convening authority deems appropriate. It seems like the CCA's point was, well, you can't really deem what's appropriate unless you have it before you. So it's sort of a presumption that there must be at least the complete rulings on all the motions and so forth, because how else is the CCA supposed to exercise that discretion?
Yes, Your Honor, and under the old system, that was the case, that the record of trial would be completed, and so the convening authority had the full record in front of him, and then could pick and choose from that record what he deemed he thought was relevant to clemency matters or to his relief authority.
But the current rule says he considers what he deems appropriate.
Yes, Your Honor.
But how does he deem what's appropriate if he doesn't have it before him?
Your Honor, the difference between the old rules and what we have now, the new system that we have, is that he can choose to act now before the record is in front of him. So the fact that the record is not complete does not affect whether or not he can act beforehand. And in this case, that's what he chose to do. He chose to act before the record of trial was complete, as he has the authority to do, because the record of trial does not need to be completed until after entry of judgment, which means you might miss some matters. Now, it would be different if he had said in his convening authority action that I waited for the full record of proceedings to be completed, or I wanted to review the full record of proceedings. And if that were the case, then we might be able to say that there was error because he didn't have the full record in front of him. But there is no language in there that signifies at all that was what he decided to do. Instead,
but to build on Judge Maggs's question, a convening authority would know in every case there are certain items, and he or she could decide based on that experience, I want to see this, I want to see that, or I don't wish to see this, I don't wish to see that. But something along these lines, the convening authority wouldn't even know that it exists unless it was brought to his or her attention. So how could the convening authority be making an informed decision in terms of that item?
Your Honor, the best place for that information would then be with the accused in the case, because the accused has the right to submit clemency matters, and the convening authority must consider the clemency matters. So if the accused wanted to ensure that the convening authority would consider those matters, the appropriate place would have been for him to write about it in his clemency matters. He did not do so. And in this case, he had the knowledge firsthand because he was the one in post-trial confinement. So if he had wanted to alert the convening authority to those conditions, even before he had written his post-trial motion, and even before he had submitted his post-trial motion to the judge, he could have included in his clemency matters, and he did not do so. Notably, in this case, he submitted two separate clemency matters and was silent on the post-trial confinement conditions in both of those. So there's no reason to believe that the convening authority in this case would have considered the post-trial confinement conditions, because nothing in the record would have otherwise brought his attention to it.
Maybe I'm mistaken, but I thought in your brief you had conceded that at least there was the potential that this issue was not ripe, so to speak, during the time frame that the accused had to file the clemency matters. Am I mistaken on that?
Your Honor, in our brief, I think what we discussed is that his clemency matters were submitted before his post-trial motion, and I apologize if I'm mistaking that, but The issue that would not have been ripe was his alerting the convening authority to his submission of the post-trial motion, which was submitted to the military judge after the clemency matter. But in the clemency matters, he could have reserved the right to submit additional clemency matters, and he didn't. As the service courts found in Way and Davis, RCM 1109 Delta 2 places no restrictions on the staff judge advocate's review either, other than that the staff judge advocate is responsible for providing legal action to the convening authority about the determination to take or to decline action. Thus, the lower court erred by judicially reviving the old system now rejected by Congress and the President. Following the plain, unambiguous language of the rules, the convening authority and the staff judge advocate properly completed their post-trial processing, and the lower court erred in holding otherwise. Moving on to my second point, the lower court erred in applying the substantial omission test for three reasons. First, the substantial omission test is neither ripe nor relevant for identification during convening authority review under the new rules. Second, the plain error standard is correct because appellee failed to file a motion to correct alleged error in the action under RCM 1104, forfeiting the issue of procedural error. Third, the substantial omission test improperly places the burden on the government to rebut a presumption of prejudice, whereas this court's precedent in Wilson rejected this assertion and placed the burden on the accused to show how he suffered prejudice from a forfeited claim of procedural error. Because the issue of the timing of the convening authority action is a procedural question, any error must be tested for material prejudice to a substantial right under Article 59 Alpha. Additionally, because the appellee had the opportunity to raise the error before the military judge under 1104 and elected not to do so, he forfeited his right to waive the error on appeal. Thus, he is not entitled to relief absent a colorable showing of prejudice due to plain error. Applying the correct test, the appellee cannot show error, or plain or obvious error at that, because the service courts are in conflict in their treatment of RCM 1109. Whereas the Air Force Court in LIVAC stated that the convening authority's decision on action occurs before the record of trial is complete, and preparation of the record continues after that, the lower court here found the convening authority's action to be premature. As in Gonzalez, any error was not plain error because the service courts have reached conflicting conclusions about the rules. And even if this court finds plain error, as in Scalo, appellee cannot make a colorable showing of prejudice because he waived the right to consideration of those confinement conditions during clemency under RCM 1106. Nothing in the rules required the convening authority or staff judge advocate to wait for the post-trial ruling, and the lower court erred in applying the substantial omission test. Accordingly, the United States asks that this court vacate the lower court's opinion and affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Lieutenant Horst.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Megan Horst, and I represent the appellee, Seaman Chase Miller. This case is about a convening authority who elected to carefully review the record of trial and believed he had. But the record was missing over 200 pages about Seaman Miller's oppressive confinement conditions that shocked the military judge. This court should remand the case for new action for three reasons. First, the convening authority elected to review the record but was unable to do so. Second, Seaman Miller was prejudiced by the convening authority's error. And third, the staff judge advocate's advice was uninformed. Beginning with my first point, in this case, the convening authority chose to review the record of trial before he took action. That is clear at Joint Appendix 180. He wrote, upon review of the record, I deny the request for deferment. He then emphasized this point by saying that after carefully reviewing the record, I decline Stephen Miller's request. But the convening authority was misled. He did not have access to the record, even as it existed at that time, because there were no materials about Seaman Miller's placement in protective custody for 33 days before him.
Why was that an error? What rule was broken, or what other legal foundation is there to say that was an error?
Your Honor, the rule that was broken, the error that the convening authority committed here was acting before he got to review the record under RCM 1109. Because under RCM 1109, he has the right to review any matters he deems appropriate, and in this case, he stated the record. And the word record is a broad, encompassing term. The government contends that our interpretation of the convening authority's action is a broad interpretation, but if there's more than one interpretation, then it should be sent back to the convening authority for clarification. And we saw this occur in United States versus Polite, where there was a question about whether or not the convening authority approved or disapproved the bad conduct discharge. And this court refused to take either interpretation from defense or the government. The solution was to send it back to the convening authority for clarification.
Well, there's no doubt, right, that we're under the new rule, right? There's
yes,
no
dispute,
right? So I look at Rule 1109, and I look at the new rule, and it says, I think the government makes this argument, and it seems to be, at least from the plain text, that the convening authority has to do two things, right? He shall consult with the staff judge advocate, and he shall consider matters timely submitted under RCM 1106. Which of those two requirements did he fail to complete?
Your Honor, he did not fail to do what's required under RCM 1109, but as soon as the convening authority elected to review the record, it became incumbent upon the government to put it before him, because he has the discretion to look at that. And if he says, I elected to review the record of trial, and on appeal it becomes very clear he did not get to review the record of trial, that's the error, and that's the violation under that rule.
Did he not have the discretion to wait for the completed record of trial before he took action?
He did, Your Honor, but he was not aware of these post-trial 39 matters. There's nothing in the record to support that he knew that this post-trial 39A was ongoing. We have the added fact here that the convening authority and the SJA are located in Norfolk, Virginia, and the military judge and Seaman Miller are in Great Lakes, Illinois. So this suggests that he didn't even know that these post-trial matters were happening. And the problem with that is that he didn't know that his sailor was in protective custody for 33 days without justification. He didn't know that his sailor was eating alone, exercising alone, unable to be let out of his cell for 33 days without knowing when that would end. And that's problematic, because that's exactly the type of material a convening authority would want to know and has the ability to correct and prevent.
So what do you want us to say? We can't say there was a Rule 1109 error, because he satisfied all the requirements of Rule 1109. So what is the opinion you want this court to write that could apply in future cases? That, I mean, do you believe that the convening authority was misled by his own staff, and went, like, that is some sort of due process or procedural error? Because we can't say they violated, I don't think we can say they violated Rule 1109.
Your Honor, RCM 1109 was violated when he elected to review the record. It could be instead that this court wants to word it in a different way, because it is confusing to say the convening authority erred when it was obviously to no fault of his own. But
can I ask you to clarify what you just said, though? You said that he violated 1109 when he chose to review the entire record?
No, Your Honor. He didn't violate 1109 by choosing to review the record.
Right.
The record.
I thought that's what you had said. What you're saying is he was going, I may have misheard. What you're saying is he was going beyond 1109.
Your Honor, 1109 allows him to consider the record. So it's not beyond 1109. It's a discretionary matter under 1109. But once that discretionary matter is elected, like the convening authority did here, it becomes not mandatory, because he could change his mind, but there's no indication that he changed his mind here. So as soon as he elected to consider the record under RCM 1109, it was incumbent upon the government to put it before him. And that could be explained because of a staff judge advocate's failure. That could have been the military judge's failure. But either way, that was the rule that was violated here. And
when we, as a court, run the risk of creating a perverse incentive? Here's what I mean by that. Clearly, senior commanders go through UCMJ training. They're required under the rule to consult with the SJA. If we were to rule in the way that you ask, couldn't there be the potential for the word on the street, so to speak, be, listen, court-martial convening authorities, when it comes to you reviewing material, if you go beyond what is strictly required under the rule, what's going to happen is this accused and other accused are going to be coming in later and saying, because you looked at one document more, they get to litigate about everything that you, as a convening authority, should have looked at.
Your Honor, I like to think that a convening authority, if he cares about the record, if he indicates that he cares about the record of trial, he wouldn't just be restricted to what's required under RCM 1109, that wouldn't somehow, the risk of future ambiguity would not deter him from caring about his jailers and caring about the court-martial that he convenes. But, Your Honor, I think what it would lead to is that the convening authority's action would be clear and unambiguous. That's not new to this court. That's not new from what this court has required, because if we can't understand what the convening authority did in his action, then it makes it a nightmare for the CCA to review it. And so I don't think the result of what I'm asking would deter a convening authority from looking at matters he wants to consider. But, of course, the convening authority has the ability to say, Judge, I only want to look at things I'm required under RCM 1109 and, put my stamp on it now because I don't care what happens afterwards. I think the lower
court... So to build, though, on Judge Hardy's question, what would you have this court point to as the basis for adopting your argument? We wouldn't be looking at the rule because your argument isn't necessarily apparent in the rule, would it? Or do you believe that the rule is exactly what we should be pointing to in terms of adopting your position?
Your Honor, I think RCM 1109 is what this court would point to, and I think the ruling would have to include that the convening authority...
What specific provision would we look at and cite to?
RCM 1109, the part of the rule that allows the convening authority to look at matters he deems appropriate.
So by allowing the convening authority to look at things, how does that evolve into required to look at things?
Because, Your Honor, we have to be able to trust what the convening authority, we have to care about what the convening authority wanted to do on review. And so if a convening authority indicates clearly that he wanted to review matters that he was not required to under the rule, then the record has to reflect that. And here that's not what happened. Here we have the convening authority electing to review the record of trial before taking action, thinking that he did, and then a CCA on appeal saying, wait a second, he was missing every single indication that there was a post-trial 39A. And but what would be the limiting principle for litigation purposes is the prejudice. And here, Seaman Miller has made a colorable showing of prejudice, because had the convening authority known about this post-trial 39A, had the convening authority known that the military judge was explicitly strongly encouraging the Navy to correct this issue, then it would have at least been a matter that he could have considered under RCM 1109.
Counsel, on this point, I understand your theory to be if the convening authority said, I'll consider the things that I have to consider, and I also am electing to consider every defense exhibit because I think it's appropriate to do so, and it turns out the third exhibit's missing, I think we would then say, well, wait a minute, he elected to consider it, and somehow it wasn't there. There's a problem. We have to send it back. But you're reading a lot into the convening authority statement saying, I have reviewed the record, I've carefully reviewed the record, to mean, something that he's that the term record really includes other things other than what was before him. I mean, I can see your point, which is that the convening authority elects to see something, says he elected to see it, and it's not there, we'd have to do something to figure that out. But here you're reading a lot into just those two little phrases. You know, I've looked at the entire record. I've carefully considered the record. How do we know that he didn't just mean, I considered everything that was before me?
Your Honor, we don't know. And the word record under RCM 1112 includes appellate exhibits. It includes the record of proceedings. It includes anything that a court-martial uses to determine findings and sentence.
Well, that's true as a legal matter, but maybe the convening authority was only referring to it as papers before. I've considered the papers before me.
Yes, Your Honor. And the answer is we don't know. And unless we send it back to the convening authority for clarification like the CCA tried to do, we won't know the answer to that. And it could very well be that when it's sent back for new action, the convening authority says, I don't want to consider these post-trial matters. It doesn't matter to me. But Congress has not eliminated the convening authority's discretion here. And what the government's asking you to do is to say it doesn't matter what the convening authority wanted to do. He did what he was required, and that's all that matters now under these new rules. And that just can't be. So I suppose my request to the court is that the opinion vindicate and give meaning to RCM 1109 to ensure that a convening authority who now cannot wait till the record is certified to act. He has to act before the entry of judgment. But he does still, under the rule, have access to the record of trial, and he can even request under the rule to have a transcript made for his review.
Counsel, what is your response to the government's argument that it was within the appellee's power to have this be to qualify under 1109? It could have been a timely submitted matter that the convening authority would have been required by the rule to consider. The government at least alleges that the appellee knew about this at day 8. They had 10 days to bring it up, and even then they could have requested a 20-day extension. So it was within the appellee's own power to ensure that these matters were raised and considered by the CA, but failed to do so.
Your Honor, the government concedes in their brief that that the conditions of Seaman Miller's protective custody confinement was not fully known until long after the defense could have submitted clemency matters under RCM 1106.
Didn't that also apply to his pretrial confinement?
Yes, Your Honor. The pretrial confinement conditions were also included in that motion, but that was included, obviously, for the post-trial 39A. But that's not really it wasn't really known to the trial defense counsel until a full exploration of the confinement conditions. And what the trial defense counsel did do was call and email the jail, called and emailed trial counsel, and when she couldn't get any results that way, she filed a motion under 1104 to the military judge to seek sentence relief. So if anything, what trial defense counsel could have done was file a motion under RCM 1104 challenging the entry of judgment. She had 5 days to do that. But the issue wasn't with the entry of judgment. The issue was with the convening authority's action. And the material prejudice from the convening authority's action didn't become a problem until the military judge's ruling, because that ruling showed the trial defense counsel what she really had. And she was anticipating getting sentence relief from the military judge. The military judge found he did not have authority to award any relief for the 33 days in protective custody. And ultimately, that's what the convening authority could have done. The convening authority could have looked and said, okay, well, trial defense counsel did, and Seaman Miller did request I defer the reduction in E1 because he was placed in protective custody for 33 days without justification, and the government grossly disregarded the treatment of these sailors, I'm going to do what he requested in his original clemency request.
But maybe I missed it in all that. But is it really your position that the appellee didn't know enough within 10 days after the sentencing to even to request for good cause a 20-day extension to look into this issue?
Your Honor, I don't think, based on the record, that the trial defense counsel knew enough about this. Based on the email traffic and her request of the memorandum of the Briggs MOU, She really didn't know enough because she was trying to figure out if this is what this if these are appropriate procedures. It wasn't clear that it was without justification.
She certainly knew that they were putting the appellee in solitary confinement at the civilian jail, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because he'd been in solitary confinement the whole pretrial confinement, and I presume they put him back in there after the findings.
Your Honor, he actually wasn't in protective custody during pretrial. What happened during pretrial confinement is that he was commingled with post-trial prisoners.
What did you just say?
During his pretrial confinement, the problem wasn't that he was placed in protective custody. He was only placed in protective custody after trial. Before trial, he was commingled with other commingled with post-trial prisoners.
I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt your sentence. Finish your sentence.
I just wanted to finish your question, sir, Your Honor, because the other thing is, it really isn't trial defense counsel's job to be putting that before the convening authority. It's the SJA's job. It's the trial counsel's job. And if nothing else, it's the military judge's job in the statement of trial results.
And so can you respond to the government's argument that the remedy here would have been for defense counsel to file a motion with the military judge under 1104 saying that there had been an error, and since they didn't do that, that's just the end of it?
Your Honor, we disagree that it was forfeited under RCM 1104 for claiming an error with the convening authority's action. Trial defense counsel had 5 days to do that because, again, the material prejudice had not been known yet at that time because the military judge's ruling wasn't issued until the entry of judgment, which was 7 days after the convening authority's action. And I recognize, Your Honor, that this court issued Brubaker Escobar the same day that Seaman Miller filed his answer. And in that case, two judges in footnote 12 acknowledged that the accused in that case forfeited the issue under the same rule. And this case is different here because of that prejudice, because the material prejudice wasn't known.
Could they have moved to file an out-of-time 1104 for good cause?
Yes, Your Honor, they could have done that, and maybe the military judge would have, maybe it would have been reviewed by the military judge and maybe not, but even if it is forfeited, even if this court finds it's forfeited, you can still review it under the plain error standard. And here, the error was clear and obvious because under any permutation of 1109, a convening authority can elect to review the record, and it's clear here that he did not review the entire record.
Yeah, so this is unrelated, but what do we make of this 15 days, that somehow the convening authority seemed to know about the 15 days? If he knew about it and he considered it, it just seems like there's no prejudice, but what do we make of this 15 days?
Your Honor, what I think we make of the 15 days is that the post-trial processing was a mess. And it may be true that the military judge awarded that 15 days, put it in the statement of trial results, but didn't provide an explanation. So, of course, when that statement of trial results goes before the convening authority, he said, okay, this is rather than 224 days of confinement credit, he's awarding 239. All right, that makes sense. And I think the 15 days just shows what triggered the lower court to say, we do not know what went on here, and we need to send it back for clarification. And, of course, the lower court could have done that probably more simply than what they did because the post-trial error was so messed up. But thank you, Your Honor.
Other questions? Thank you. Lieutenant Crochet's here.
Your Honors, I'd briefly like to make 2 points. The first is that the issue in this case is not about the convening authority's discretion and what he took discretion to do and consider and being deprived of that. The issue is the lower court's holding that the bottom line is that the military judge's ruling did not exist either in written or oral form at the time of the convening authority's action. And that takes away the discretion from the convening authority to be able to act before the complete record of trial. There's nothing in RCM 1109 that says that the convening authority must wait for the complete record of trial then to decide what to consider for clemency. That was under the old system, where the record of trial was complete, the staff judge advocate had to review the complete record, and then the convening authority decided. Not so here.
Counsel, how do you respond, though, to the appellee's argument that the convening authority says, I want to review the entire record, and believes that he's reviewed the entire record, but in fact didn't have the entire record before him, such that he didn't have to review it all, but he wanted to, thought he did, but then didn't. Is that an error?
If he thought he did and did not have the record in front of him, that could be error, Your Honor. But the language in the convening authority's action is unambiguous here, and it's clearly boilerplate language that says, after careful consideration of the record, that comes two sentences in the same paragraph in the same section after matters considered, where he discusses precisely what matters he considered. And even if the court finds that was error, we still don't get to, one, plain error, but we also don't get to prejudice. And in this case, there's nothing to say the convening authority would have acted where the appellee in the case didn't think it was severe enough to note in clemency matters, didn't think it was severe enough to bring in 1104 matters, didn't think it was important enough to bring in on appeal.
On the plain error issue, what about the appellant's argument that, well, we couldn't really file our 1104 motion at that time because we didn't know at that time what the military judge was going to rule. And so it's not like we forfeited it because we didn't really have a chance to raise it.
Chief Judge, I see that I'm out of time. May I answer?
Please.
In that case, under 1104, the accused could have still brought up a motion. If not about convening authority action error, that could have been submitted along with the post-trial motion itself, because at that point the appellee knew that he was filing that motion. He could have jointly added on there an 1104 error to say, please consider this clemency matter, but did not do so. He could have also submitted an error saying that the convening authority did not wait for the post-trial record to be completed, knowing that there would be this motion and knowing that there would be a ruling later on, but he didn't do so. And most notably, he didn't raise the issue on appeal about the post-trial confinement conditions altogether, which is important for us because it shows that there's no prejudice in this case where the convening authority would not have considered the matter.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides. The court will stand in recess until 10:45.